From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for July 15th, 2022. The Brewers are in San Francisco this weekend, just before the All-Star break. And Bastille Days is also happening this weekend. It's been a very strange week on the planet. A Nashville hot dog restaurant is getting into the reproductive discussion by offering free milkshakes to all the customers who show proof of a vasectomy. What's proof? Doctor's note? A scar? I hope it's not a scar. And in Texas, a pregnant woman was ticketed for driving in the high occupancy lane. She claims Texas law deems a fetus is a person. Therefore, there were two people in the car, and they had every right to use the HOV lane. From a legal point of view, this should be fun to watch. In rural Spain, a far-right political party has recently ruled you can't have sex for the fun of it. Sex is only meant for procreation. I suspect those Spanish conservatives aren't doing it right. This next one is kind of disturbing, as if they all weren't so far. If a loved one has passed and you want to remember them by their tattoo, call Save My Ink Forever. It's an Ohio-based firm that retrieves tattoos and surrounding skin from the deceased and then preserves it and frames it for all the world to see. Or probably not at Grandma's house. And speaking of death, a prisoner who died was brought back to life by the prison doctors. He claims his life sentence has technically ended. On the podcast today, we have Art Rothschild, Chris Everett, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max. A tough week overall for markets, although some positive numbers today. The NASDAQ down 1.6% this week, closing at 11,452. The S&P 500 closing down 0.9% this week, closing at the belt 3863. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 656 points today, but it wasn't enough for the week, down 52 points, closing at 31,286. That's down 0.2%. For the year, the NASDAQ, 26.5% decline so far this year. The S&P 500 down 18.3%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 13%. So, Art, obviously plenty to be happy about today, but more of the same, it seems, the rest of this week. We into the middle, or really into the beginning of the earnings season now, and really looking at what that means for investors, a lot of conversations perhaps about what going forward looks like. Certainly happy with a big update today, but, you know, again, I think investors are left with a lot to think about as we dive into earnings season here.
Yeah, I can remember countless shows on which we were talking about looking forward to earnings season. And in just about every earnings season for countless years, earnings were coming in higher than expectations and stocks would climb higher and higher and higher. And this went on for quite some time. This is not that time. Now everyone's scouring these earnings reports for signs that things are really getting worse. And maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But I've never seen more speculation, you know, in the markets than I'm seeing right now. And speculation is, you know, I've commented before, it's not an investment strategy. So what's really driving the markets, aside from the war in Ukraine, which continues to simmer in the background, is Fed policy. And this week, a big driver, of course, is, consumers are still spending money. Oh, my God, inflation's at 9.1%. And the Fed is going to raise rates. I guess the odds are 80% now that they're going to raise rates 1% instead of 0.75%. And it's like, what difference does it make at this point? We know what they're going to do. We know it's going to have some impact, but they're doing it for good reason. They're trying to, so it's frustrating. You know, as an advisor, it's frustrating as an investor to see, you know, losses when nothing's really changed other than the outlook per se. So it's, you're right. It's just another week like we've had over and over. But if I'm not mistaken, you're better on the numbers than I am, but we're only down 18% year to date on the S&P. That's better than we were to start the month. So let's celebrate.
Yeah, it depends on when you're looking, right? It depends on how you measure. You could just as easily say, where are we from, you know, the bottom of COVID or the pre-COVID peak, going back to, you know, right before the markets fell apart pre-COVID, we're still up 14%. And so I think it's, some of this is the time period you're looking at, but we can't discount just how challenging of a year it's been. And so I think as we enter earnings season here, as we kind of digest, okay, now we're hearing, you know, business leaders talk about the impact that inflation's having on their bottom line, the impact that continued COVID shutdowns are having on their bottom line. And I think it drives, you know, as you point out, it drives a lot of people crazy, right? It drives a lot of people to go, okay, well, I have to do something. I have to stop the bleeding. And Chris, I know the behavioral economics, the behavioral finance side of this is something we talk about quite a bit. You know, there's this concept out there called regret minimization, right? How do you feel better about your portfolio? Well, one way you could do that is to minimize the decisions you might regret. And so, you know, what are we doing right now? What should we be doing right now to try to minimize the pain that we're feeling, to try to minimize the maybe behavioral aspect of these market declines?
Well, it's an interesting question because sometimes the best thing to do and what might help you sleep at night isn't the thing that a spreadsheet would tell you is the perfect answer, right? So I think about an example of I'm having a discussion with a client about should they or should they not take on, you know, debt on this car loan or on this mortgage. And I would say, hey, the spreadsheet would tell you at this low of an interest rate all day you should borrow that money. But how do you feel whether you hold that additional amount of debt, right? So sometimes the spreadsheet and what makes sense for you aren't always the exact same thing. So, you know, a corollary to that would be, you know, when there's these pullbacks in the market, you know, the smart money might say, well, long term, you're probably going to be better off starting to add risk, right? And it might be best to put it all in because over the long term, stocks tend to rise. But you're really not going to be happy if you put money in and then see the market fall. So sometimes it's best to slowly add into the market. Let's say if in your mind you want to add 10% more of your allocation to stocks, we'll split that up amongst, you know, 3, 4, 5 different purchases over a course of a handful of months so that if you don't pick the bottom, because you won't, you know, you're not going to, well, at least you feel better because you've spread that over a period of time and you didn't put it to work and the next thing you know, the market slid further and you're not able to sleep at night.
Yeah, you know, so much economic research, so much behavioral or, you know, psychological research that backs a lot of that. And I think, you know, so often our conversations are, here's what the numbers say, right? Here's what the economy is doing now, and here's what, you know, we should be doing as a result. And I think it's a good reminder. These kinds of markets are a good reminder that this isn't strictly about making sure that the numbers line up. It's about making sure that you're comfortable with what you have. Even in the economic data, we see some of it, Joel, right? The consumer sentiment numbers this week, it's a good example of how even as certain things are going on, consumers can feel sometimes a different way about what's going on in the economy.
Right, yeah. We got the preliminary numbers for consumer sentiment for July from the University of Michigan. Remember, in June, it was at an all-time low, so it's a little bit up from that. One of the things that improved is more consumers are realizing that the supply crunch is easing a little bit, so that's good. But otherwise, people are pretty sour on spending money and saying that inflation is eroding their ability to live their standard of living. It's that sentiment has never been higher since the Great Recession. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, we're not seeing a whole lot of evidence that consumers are being affected by that they're actually curtailing their spending. We had numbers today from the Commerce Department on retail spending, and that went up in the month of June. Now, part of that is that those numbers aren't corrected for inflation, so the nominal numbers showed that retail spending went up by 1% from May, but if you corrected for inflation, actually it went down by 0.3%. But bottom line for consumers is that they still spent more money in June than they did in May at grocery stores and gas stations, online, at bars and restaurants.
Yeah, I spent 1% more chasing slightly fewer goods and services, right? And so that's the you know, the difference between that nominal and that real, or what's stated versus what we actually see when you adjust for
inflation. And getting back into the psychology of it, Mohammed Al-Aryan, economist, I saw that he tweeted yesterday about all of the headlines of, you know, we had reports this week of 41-year highs for inflation numbers, and those were the headline numbers, and I can talk more about the under the headline numbers if you want, but he was registering concern that just those headlines and just all of the talk, I mean, there's a lot of political campaign talk about how high inflation is right now, that that affects consumers in that they start thinking that prices are rising actually faster than they are, or that the situation is worse than it is. One of the findings in the University of Michigan survey was they found more consumers saying that they're buying things now because they don't want to wait to buy it when they need it because they're afraid it'll cost too much. So some of those things sort of feed into a frenzy, and that helps fuel inflation.
But to a certain extent, it's serving the Fed's purpose, because it shows that they're conveying, you know, they're trying to get people a little bit depressed about spending so they aren't chasing as many goods, you know, as they were before. And I think we're beginning to see that they're having some success. I think there was some statistic you would have seen, or I think we all saw this week, that suggested that the expectations for future inflation have gone down.
Right.
And this is what the Fed's most concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have the most competent bunch of, you know, Fed governors I've ever seen. And so, you know, I think, but what they want to do is they want to get people to spend less, to drive prices up less. And I think this is, I think it's actually good news. And news travels, information travels so
right.
quickly.
Those medium term expectations are for inflation are becoming anchored more. They're either going down or they're staying stable. Mm-hmm. And that's based on the Michigan survey, but also on a survey that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York does.
Yeah.
And that's encouraging. And if I may, I mean, below some of those headline numbers for inflation this week, so we had it for consumer price index and for the producer price index, both of those showed that if you take out some of the more volatile categories, the food, the gasoline, I mean, gasoline prices, you know, we're up by 60% in the last year, according to the CPI survey. If you take those out, year over year, both of those indexes show the rate of inflation actually has gone down the last 3 months. I mean, it's still very high, but it's coming down a little, and that's encouraging.
And certainly that's something, Chris, you've been talking about on the podcast, something worth pointing out this week, you know, a barrel of oil back below $100. For West Texas Intermediate, so the stuff that, you know, we're using to refine pretty regularly for gasoline, that doesn't immediately make its way into your price at the pump. And so, you know, I think one thing that continues to catch so many people's attention is that gasoline is way more expensive than it was 18 months or 2 years ago, but it's also come down significantly. And you look at any other number of input goods, whether it's a barrel of cotton or I don't know how we measure cotton, I guess, but a bushel of corn, you know, whatever it is, and copper in particular is a pretty significant input cost for building. All those prices have come down.
Yeah, Kyle, I mean, if you think about the chain reaction that needs to occur before it actually starts to show up in CPI data, I mean, you think about, okay, the Fed raises rates, okay, then you need to see some sort of reaction in terms of home builders slowing down building, okay? Once they've slowed down building, now the demand that they have for lumber or copper or whatever, aluminum, whatever these raw materials are, then it works its way into the price, and then we wait another month before it's seen in the CPI data. So there is this inevitable lag between the actions that are taken and the effect that it actually has on CPI. So we're inherently always looking backwards when we look at this previous CPI. You know, the highest measures were energy, but I imagine in the next reading we're going to notice, oh, look, energy prices were actually dragging down the overall CPI report in the month of July. So, you know, you're always backwards looking, but we're getting these spot price updates on commodities, and that gives us a little bit of a look ahead of what the next few months might look like as well.
But the Fed knows what's going to happen and when, mm-hmm. sort of. They don't know exactly what's going to happen, but they're looking for solid evidence. And they're not going to stop raising rates mm-hmm. until they get that. They've made that perfectly clear. And quite frankly, despite the increases in interest rates that they've levied this year, the interest rate is still below the inflation rate. So they're giving money away, which is still stimulative. So all this complaining about higher interest rates, I'm getting kind of tired of it. Don't fight the Fed. I mean, old Wall Street adage, it's so true. But the concern is, oh, the Fed's going to go too far. They're going to cause a recession. We don't know that. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know when or if it's going to happen. We don't know how significant it's going to be if we have one. And let's not forget, just 2 years ago, we had a recession, shortest one in history. 2008, 2009, we had one of the most significant ones in history. This doesn't look anything like that. So every time we've had one of these, stocks go down and stocks recover. So just be careful not to react too much to the news by, as you suggested earlier, making a mistake with respect to your portfolio.
And a little silver lining in those CPI numbers, remember that the Consumer Price Index is what Social Security bases its cost of living adjustment on. So they take numbers from part of the CPI survey. It's for urban wage earners and clerical workers, and they take it for June, July, and August, and then based on that, they determine how much Social Security benefits go up next year. This year, they went up 5.9%. That's the most it was since 1981, when it went up 11.2%. So, and we know that 1981 is the place we keep looking back to say, you know, inflation hasn't been high since then.
You know, I think the Fed's response to this, the raising of interest rates, has done a number of things to markets that have, you know, far-ranging impacts. One of those is certainly the attractiveness of bonds long-term, but the other is just how attractive it makes the U.S. dollar, right? We see foreign investors that now see higher interest rates in the U.S. than they see in their own country, or just more stability overall than they see in their own country, and they want to go ahead and buy those U.S. dollar-denominated treasury bonds. Well, the only way you can do that is to get into U.S. dollars. And so, you know, we see folks from all over the world coming into the dollar, bidding up the price of the dollar. And this week we got news that the dollar and the euro are now trading at parity, which means that for every U.S. dollar you have, you can get 1 euro. I seem to remember, you know, the euro first trading and those first few years, it was considerably more expensive. And so a lot of impacts from dollar strength. It sounds good on the surface, right? You want the dollar to be strong as an American consumer, and for a variety of reasons you do. But Art, there's a lot of reasons why maybe dollar strength isn't all good, right? A lot of good, a lot of bad.
Yeah, first and foremost, on the negative side, it means that U.S. multinationals translating their foreign earnings into U.S. dollars have lower profits. And that's the biggest negative that I can envision. But on the plus side, the impact on inflation. You know, with a stronger dollar, U.S. consumers can buy foreign stuff for less, and that helps the Fed, you know, reduce the rate of inflation. One of the things we've talked about, you might bring up later, you know, China weakening as much as they are. They might have to sell stuff even cheaper, make more stuff more cheaper. And so, if that's a term, a stronger dollar does make it less competitive for U.S. exporters, you know, versus foreign exporters. And of course, it's making it, one of the articles I read recently indicated that, for example, it makes oil prices, you know, higher, for example, for the Germans who are using it as input, you know, to manufacture things. So Germany's having issues, Europe's having issues because of dollar strength. Not a good thing for them. So far, I think better for us based on everything, you know.
Yeah,
what I'm saying.
Certainly travel and,
oh my God,
and
yes,
consumption of foreign goods look far more affordable than they otherwise would. Again, given how far prices have risen on a lot of that stuff, they look a little more affordable now because you can get, you know, you can buy a euro or you can buy something in Europe for a little cheaper when you put it in dollar terms. I think the other thing we need to point out is that there are a lot of emerging market countries and a lot of businesses in parts of the world where maybe borrowing is a little bit more difficult that have had to borrow in dollars. And so it makes it a little more expensive for those countries, those businesses, to pay back that debt. And so a little bit of a cautionary tale potentially for those areas of the world that are borrowing in dollars, were borrowing on the fact that they thought that, you know, growth was going to be through the roof the next 10 or 20 years. Well, prospects for growth have slowed a little. Oh, and by the way, it's going to cost you a lot more to pay back that dollar-denominated debt because now your currency is not worth as much. And so I think that's a meaningful risk, albeit a small risk for most investors. It's not something, you know, that we really participate in all that much or that the mutual funds we look at regularly participate in. But it is something that investors should be aware of. It isn't again all good just because the dollar sounds, just because we can say that the dollar is stronger. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one more thing worth pointing out this week, it's the time of year when we get a lot of mid-year outlooks. It's the time of year when every investment bank, every economics research group is talking about what the next 6 months, year, 18 months look like. We got a question from a pretty regular listener this week pointing us to the BlackRock mid-year outlook, and the fact that BlackRock is now suggesting that they're more bearish, certainly than they were earlier in the year, but even maybe a little more bearish short-term on stocks than what they've been in the past. And, had a chance, Chris, to digest some of what BlackRock had to say. But I think it's always interesting to separate, first and foremost, the difference between some of those tactical views, right, some of the short-term positions versus some of what we're talking about more strategically, where should we be long-term? And some obvious differences, I think, in BlackRock's report and certainly in some of the others I've seen between kind of the short-term view and the long-term.
Yeah, Kyle, if you think about it in the short term, a lot of times that's a momentum thing, right? What direction are stocks currently heading? And we're going to extrapolate that further. So BlackRock saying, hey, in the short term, we're a little bearish on equities or, a little downbeaten on equities here. But in the long term, we think things are going to be all right. Well, what I really care about is long term, taking it further. Frankly, I have a hard time giving a lot of credence to Wall Street expectations at the beginning of the year and what they say they're going to have. I mean, it's like clockwork, 8 to 10% is earnings growth for every single year, and that's what they expect for the S&P. And, shorthand, yep, historically that's what we've seen for the S&P long-term growth, but it doesn't happen year to year like that. It's just a nice shorthand guess for a lot of Wall Street banks. So I think we all have to have some humility here to say we don't know exactly what's going to happen in a 12-month time period or 6-month time period. So I'm not going to expect that some Wall Street bank will give me the perfect answer either. So we got to build our portfolios regardless.
I think what I appreciate so much about that humility is BlackRock themselves is essentially saying we were wrong 6 months ago, but don't worry, now this is the correct forecast. And so, that's not unique to them, and I'm certainly not knocking them. They have a wonderful research team. They're one of the biggest firms out there doing that, and they do an incredible job. I think it speaks to just how useless these short-term forecasts really can be outside of just setting some general expectations. Yeah, things probably going to be bumpy for a little while longer. That really isn't outside the realm of what we've been talking about, for the better part of the stretch of this year so far, and I think absent, BlackRock saying it, I don't think it would have changed too many people's minds on what the short term looks like. So, I want to stress that, I'm pretty comfortable with what they're saying long term, a slightly overweight view from them and from many others on kind of where we should be in terms of our stock positioning. But I do take some of what they say with a grain of salt and certainly accept some of it that maybe we got to be a little more cautious through this year. Plan a little bit ahead, really think about how we're going to get cash if you need distributions, really think about how we're going to take advantage of the opportunities when they emerge, because it isn't as simple as just saying, well, we can sell growth stocks that are up 60% in the last 3 years, because they're not there anymore. So, I think it's a really important thing to have those kinds of guides, have those kinds of forecasts, but you got to put them in the proper perspective. Well, thanks for listening. We enjoy doing the program for you, and we will talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.